Good evening, everyone. So this is week four of Dharma Seminar Series that I've been calling Difference and Unity, Encountering Injustice on the Bodhisattva Path. So how many of you are here for the first time? Not first time ever, but first time. How many are here for the first time? So welcome to both of you. And how many are here for the first time during this series? Yeah, a few. And some of you have been here for all or some of these, which is totally fine. But I will just repeat myself just a little to introduce what we've been doing. We've been talking about how we humans perceive difference as threat often. And that's natural. And the way we divide self from other, me and mine versus you and yours, us and ours versus them and theirs. And how we use these perceptions of difference, consciously and unconsciously, to justify not only our own harmful behaviors, often in, you know, what we think is our best interests, but quite harmful behaviors and speech at times, on an individual basis and also collectively, you know, in our social and political structures. And those difference may be based on many things, gender, sexuality, we've talked about, race, class, ability, age, appearance, even species. Right? And we've been exploring how Buddhist perspectives and practices can support us to see clearly the roots of suffering based on difference, and to respond with open hearts and minds, and not in simply conditioned ways. So this week, I'd like to talk about race. And as with each of these topics, this one is daunting, both personally and politically. It feels that even to attempt to speak for a half an hour is to do injustice to the topic. And yet, this one has a big place in my heart. And to be silent, to shy away, is to be complicit in a larger silence. So I'm going to be, I think, more personal tonight with this one than I have been, and I hope that you'll appreciate why. I grew up in a small town in New Jersey. Do people know where that is?
Which one?
A little town in the middle of New Jersey, 15 miles from Trenton, the capital. And 15 miles another direction from Princeton, where the university, famous university, is. And I went to the Calvary Baptist Church, which stood on the main intersection of town, which didn't used to even have a traffic light, but now it does. And the bank was on this side, and the drugstore was over here, and a big Victorian doctor's house was over here. And it was a plain white clapboard church, Doric columns across the front that had been added. And starting in the very earliest years of Sunday school, like preschool, you can picture the room in the basement, I learned to sing this song. Jesus loves the little children, all the children of the world. Red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight. Jesus loves the little children of the world. Anybody else know that? Not so much the younger ones here, but... So our town had another Baptist church, and it was called the Second Calvary Baptist Church. And it was located on the two blocks on the eastern edge of town where all the black people lived. And it was a little plainer, a little smaller than ours. Ours wasn't fancy, but this one was plainer. And one day when I was small, my mother took my sister and me to hear a concert, an evening concert, at Second Calvary by Earl Hubbard's All-Girl Chorus. And they were from the big, tough city of Trenton. Earl Hubbard was a small, dapper black man. I learned many years later was a very accomplished violinist. And the chorus members were not girls. They were women. Substantial women with voices like I had never heard before. That sent chills up my spine when they sang, "Sometimes it causes me to tremble, tremble, tremble. Were you there when they crucified my Lord?" I'd sing it, but I'm too shy. I can't sing it like them. They had something that we did not in our pallid hymns. I think that it was even earlier than that occasion that I went, I was young, on a church mission to distribute Christmas baskets to the poor in the slums of Newark, New Jersey. That was about a 45-minute drive away, but it was another world. Newark was the location of some of the worst race riots in what was called the long, hot summer of 67. 26 people died and hundreds were injured. I only remember one scene from that day. This is a little piece from a poem I wrote about it. All was not well when we entered the bare kitchen. A massive black woman in short skirt and sleeveless undershirt sat at a chrome table, unsmiling, wordlessly ordering her children to stay in the other room. There were only two rooms, in stony refusal to be shamed by us. One year, as I was approaching adolescence, I attended with my family one of the periodic church meetings. We had these democratic church meetings, right? Preceded by what was called a covered dish supper. We call them potlucks now. And at the meeting, someone made a motion to invite the members of Second Calvary to come to our church services because they were temporarily without a minister. And the motion was voted down on the grounds that they were welcome, of course, but they wouldn't be comfortable. So with my adolescence keen sensitivity to hypocrisy, I knew I couldn't stay too much longer in my church. Stayed in maybe another year to sing in the, because I'd just gotten into the adult choir. But then our minister left. He was a minister who talked more about civil rights than hellfire and brimstone. And he left the ministry to go into community development. And I left too. I went on to high school. And by then, my country was engaged in a racist war in Vietnam. I reached a point where I could no longer in good conscience pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And I think I'll read you another poem. In my high school graduating class of not quite 200, there were three black students. This is dedicated to one of them, Bobby. separated by the letter B, McA and McC, side by side in homeroom for 6 years, separated by gender, race, and that great gap ever since 7A and 7E, between the smart kids and the dumb. That's what they called us. For all that divided us, you knew I was not only smart, but anguished. I knew you were not only dumb, but kind. I helped you with your math. You asked, "Are you okay?" Touched my sleeve lightly as I hid my face in my arms on that table we all sat around in the home ec room amid the stoves and sewing machines. What did you think when I could no longer bear to put my hand over my heart and pledge allegiance to the flag, standing silent and stubborn beside you? Later, to be blackballed from the National Honor Society by our homeroom teacher, Mrs. Day, a distinction you did not have the privilege of sharing. Nor could you have burned your college applications in lieu of a draft card, as I did. Were you drafted? Did you go? Are you still alive? No word of you at any of those reunions I didn't attend either. What if we'd both rebelled, gone to the senior prom together, danced till the floor smoked, shown them all how much more we were than white and black, smart and dumb? I was no more able to conceive of such an act than you were then, and even if we could have, we would have gone our separate ways, torn and hopeful. When I was 19, I left my country for Canada, and I landed in a white Anglophone county of Maritime, New Brunswick. I was quite puzzled by the French-English antipathy. I didn't get it. So different from the race-based issues I'd grown up with. However, it was still the East Coast, and the reality of racism in the lives of Indigenous people remained invisible to me until I reached Vancouver some years later, but that's yet another story. The nearest city then was Moncton, an hour's drive away over seasonally hazardous roads. Moncton was quite provincial in those days. So after a few years having exhausted the public library, I was thrilled to learn that a real bookstore had come to Moncton. When I went in, I was in seventh heaven, browsing to my heart's content, trying to decide what very special purchase I would make. Now, my partner and I then, with our long hair, scruffy t-shirts and jeans, must have looked more like hippie transients than the hard-working organic farmers we were. But still, it came as a terrible shock when the woman owner came up to us and demanded that we leave immediately. She was absolutely, utterly convinced that we had been there a week before and stolen books. There was nothing we could say to dissuade her. Her threatening manner only escalated. I was mortified to be banished from a bookstore. I was shamed, angry, grieved. For months afterward, I wrote mental letters that I never sent to that woman. I bring this up because the imprint of that experience has come back to me many times whenever I hear about racial profiling. What if this kind of experience had been part of my everyday life from my earliest childhood? What if I witnessed my parents being shamed in that way? What if it, as a parent, my child, likely my boy child, my beautiful, smart, kind boy child, was dragged in and searched by store security repeatedly, even roughed up? Would I be angry? You bet I would. I would feel anger, shame, fear, profound grief, even despair. I might feel like I would die without my anger. When I lived in Japan years ago, I got a taste of what it feels like to be the racial other. Just a taste, but it was visceral. To sit on a bus beside the only empty seat and see people standing rather than sit beside you. To say something to a store clerk in perfectly clear Japanese and see the deer in the headlights glaze over look. The blank stare of incomprehension because the words are coming from a white face. Another thing I experienced, and have you ever been on a line up here, right, in our own city and seen an interaction, you know, where someone speaks who is other, maybe with an accent, and they're met with a blank stare, or maybe even disdain, why can't you speak English, you know? We see this. I'll often turn to the person who has spoken, because I usually do understand what they say, and say, like, did you want to know if this is the sale price? And they'll nod, and then the clerk will hear that. Another thing I experienced in Japan was the seductive relief that comes with passing. Like when a bent old lady with poor eyesight would ask me to help her buy her train ticket. And then we'd chat for a bit without her realizing that I was a gaijin. The word for a foreigner in Japan, some of you may know this, is a word, gaijin, outside person. You're an outsider. Now, despite these experiences, I think through my early adult life, I was quite limited in my capacity to move into the world, speaking, acting, writing, to express my response, to make a difference. I was, as clearly as I saw these things I'm describing, I was blind to the gender and class factors in my own life, my own family. Communicated by my own society that constrained my voice, that kept me silent. I thought my limitations were my personal deficiencies. Has anyone ever felt like, you know, what's wrong with me? It took years of reading, life experience, feminist insight, and most important, this practice that we share, to, without turning self-blame into other blame, to see how truly complex and deep-rooted the big picture is. Our karmic lives are not individual, but completely intertwined with others throughout space and time. Greed, hatred, and ignorance, the three poisons, right? Are what contaminate our views, our speech, and our actions, and blind us to the Buddha nature that we share. I can know this, I can feel it deeply, but conditioning is strong and rooted through generations so that I can still turn away, shy away, fear of getting it wrong, you know, those subtle little avoidances from engagement with those who are different from us, right? And it is my responsibility to attend to that. And it's our responsibility to attend to that together. So you may be wondering why, you know, now, if this is about race, why is she going on and on about her own experiences? And not talking about the terrible ongoing racial injustices in our world, in our nation, in our own communities. But I'll tell you why. Because you don't need me to tell you about that. There are plenty of voices trying to tell you about that. They're using journalism, fiction, poetry, film, visual art, dance, political action, teaching, and the Dharma. They're easy to find, the voices that are trying to tell you what it's like to be the other. Even in sanghas, what it's like to be non-white in a white sangha. Here in Canada, it's First Nations voices that have a similar anguish and urgency to that which propels the Black Lives Matter movement in the States. So whether it's Idle No More, or hashtag Me Too, or our neighbor, work colleague, or sangha member, it's our responsibility to listen, to learn, not to turn away. So maybe my half-hour talk here is just an imperfect effort to model that kind of self-inquiry. An exploration of others' perspectives that I'm asking, challenging, inviting you to do. There's always more to be done. We have to get out of our heads and their endless self-justifying wrangling and get into our guts and know how hatred, shame, fear, and distrust feel, how yearning and hopelessness feel. We need to get in touch with our own hearts and minds with scrupulous honesty. You know the Japanese word sesshin, which means an intensive Zen retreat? Those two characters in sesshin mean to touch the heart-mind. That character means both heart and mind. Touching the heart-mind, becoming intimately acquainted with the conditioned, impermanent nature of our being. And in doing so, we discover that those deeply tangled roots of suffering that touch, the deeper you go, the more they touch, say, the roots of each other's suffering. We all grow from the same muddy waters of this earthly life, right? And that lotus flower of awakening comes directly out of those muddy waters. Angel Kyodo Williams, Black American Zen teacher, co-wrote a book with a couple of colleagues called Radical Dharma. She says she gets tired of members of predominantly white sanghas saying, "Oh, how can we attract more people of color?" But being unwilling to examine their own blind spots and assumptions, or their own suffering around issues of difference. There's a new book out by a Black British journalist, Rennie Edo Lodge, called Why I'm Not Talking to White People About Race. You might see the cover and the Why I'm Not Talking About, and the white is blacked out, but you can just see the embossed letters. It's very clever. She admits that she does talk about race with some white people, but she is compelling in her description of the effect that certain responses have in stopping real heartfelt exchange. I'm not racist. I don't see color. I didn't do any of those things. That's the past. Why are you so angry? Watch out for those ones. Canadian First Nations novelist Thomas King, who wrote the nonfiction The Inconvenient Indian, confirms that same effect of those types of responses about Indigenous issues. That unwillingness to both look at our own unexamined biases and to take collective responsibility for the North American colonial enterprise being founded on the genocide and slavery of millions of people. People. So if gender, as I mentioned on the night that I talked about, gender is our oldest splitting of self and other. Maybe race is the second oldest. Fear and hatred of the other, the outsider, is deeply rooted in our tribal past. And it's not simply based on race as we conventionally use the term. It turns out that red and yellow, black and white is a social construct. That particular configuration only came into being in the 19th century. It certainly doesn't describe the variations of human beings on this earth. And we all go way, way back to Mother Africa, right? And we fanned out across the globe in a great variety of forms and cultures and bodies that differ very little genetically. Black American journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates, strongly recommended, argues that no coherent fixed definition of race actually exists. It is what we say it is. And that has been based on religious, ethnic, geographical factors which may or may not be at all consistent with what color our skin is or what kind of hair we have. And although history is full of bloody conflicts based on such differences, some of the most brutal have been between groups whose physical characteristics, call them racial, or are hardly distinguishable. Irish Catholics versus Irish Protestants, Rwandan Hutus versus Tutsis, Turks versus Armenians, Hindus versus Pakistanis, Hindus versus Muslims in India. If we look at many of those conflicts, we see the legacy of colonialism. Thankfully, we do have examples of peaceful coexistence, both between and within societies, though unfortunately they seem more the exception than the rule. But we humans evolve and adapt through culture, right? So we have the capacity to make choices about our directions and our values. There is arguably some evidence that we can choose more peaceful and harmonious ways of living on this earth. In my little private notebook in high school, I wrote, is there any evidence? Is there any evidence that we humans have learned how to be more peaceful and harmonious? The evidence seems slim, but it is there if we take the long view. Classical Buddhist teachings don't really address issues of race specifically, since India was pretty racially homogenous, as was China, as was Japan, the route through which this particular tradition came to us. Though the caste system in India did include skin color in its distinctions. And we'll talk about class and caste. But the Dharma is unequivocal. The Buddha was unequivocal that all beings have and are Buddha nature. All of us are engaged in awakening to a conscious way of living. In my talks in this series, I've been referencing a key Zen text, a poem from 8th century China called Merging of Difference and Unity. Some of you know it well. about the Buddha's teaching of two truths, the two truths. In the poem, the truth of difference, particularity, relativity, is represented by light, because in light we can see that each of us here is very a unique person. And the truth of unity, oneness, the absolute, is represented as darkness, because in darkness everything merges. So a few lines from the poem go like this: in the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and dark oppose one another like the front and back foot in walking. In our everyday world of distinctions, the unity of all things is always right there. And in oneness, the particularity of phenomena is always there. What I love about this view is that the light isn't good and positive and the darkness bad and negative. Contrary to our Western mythology, darkness is richly generative, full of possibility. How liberating that white isn't right or wrong, black isn't beautiful or ugly. This view gives us the capacity, I think, to see and listen to the lived experience of someone different from ourselves, and to feel our human connection at the same time. It feels to me like there's a life and death urgency for us to develop that capacity in our world today. Because we can be sure that there will be even more geographical displacement and movement of people across the world, more fear, more instability. So let's start from the only place we can, with our own hearts and minds, knowing and intending that that awareness extend without limit out into the world. So I think I'll close there. More to come. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for listening. And I'd like to give you a chance to share some reflections with each other, as we've done these past few weeks. I'm going to ask you to just think back to your early years, an early awareness of race, of racial difference. And how did your family and social environment shape that, or influence that early awareness? And then, often in childhood, certain questions arise, if there was there a point where we started to question or see injustice. That comes to us sometimes along the way, and sometimes it's through a person, of being a experiencing injustice or witnessing injustice or harm. Okay, so think about that. And what I'm going to ask you to do, like we did last week, is make two circles. So Michael's at that end, people on that end, make a circle around where Michael is, and it'll be more of an oval. And people on this end, make a circle over here. And then we'll try and even them out, make sure they're about the same number of people.